You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Hello, dear fellow animals. Thanks for coming when you could have been out sniffing the bins if you were a dog, or laughing until you fart if you were a bonobo, or indeed dreaming if you were a baby jumping spider. Animals heal us, as anybody who's ever had a pet knows. Animals heal the individual psychologically. In animal-assisted therapy, different creatures, from doves to skunks and donkeys to parakeets, have healing effects. They lessen depression, anxiety, and social withdrawal. They increase self-confidence, social skills, and empathy, amongst many other things. And time spent with animals, particularly horses, is incredibly helpful for people with autism. A service dog can pull a wheelchair, find lost things, put laundry in a machine, and take it out when the wash is done. While a psychiatric service dog can do all those things, but can also note mood swings and can alert their human early by nudging or barking, sometimes dropping a really big hint, bringing medication to a person on the edge. In the USA, dogs can call 911, that's the American equivalent of 999, in a house fire or other crisis. The dog touches a screen, it's placed at dog height with three separate circles, with a 9 and a 1 and a 1 in the circles. And if the dog presses those circles with their nose in the right order, a message is automatically sent through to the emergency services. Animals help heal the epidemic of loneliness. I feel it because writing is very lonely work. And there was a study done a few years ago of elderly dog owners living alone, where 75% of the men and 67% of the women said their dog was their only friend. And I think that's completely heartbreaking. It's also completely heart-mending. So a crucial part of health is vitality. And animals vitalize our minds with their presence, with their joie de vivre. A crucial part of health is vitality. Animals vitalize our minds with their presence, with their joie de vivre. Some 65 species of animals are known to laugh, including rats, who laugh if you tickle them. Also dogs and primates. Bonobos, if tickled, make a choked gasp of laughter, followed by a peep of pleasure. You know the one. Fits of laughter in stitches. The bit when your entire body convulses with vibrations as if all your organs are being massaged by the bubbles of 101 jacuzzis. And you are both the jacuzzi and the jacuzzed. That one. That kind of laughter. It's famously the best medicine. Animals play. Ravens, as well as lambs, play King of the Castle. Turtles play tug of war, as do wolves, who also play tag and pounce on sleeping wolves just for fun. Elephants do that as well. They wait in the mud when they're little and they just pounce on a sleeping elephant. Kittens chase their own tails as if they kept the catnip there. Leverets leap with a levity that is gravity-defying. All mammals at play do joy jumps, including goats, dogs, cats, and horses. And watching any animal playing, my human borders kind of crumble and my responsibilities to seriousness dissolve like a biscuit in tea. In one astonishing discovery, neurologists have shown that when we see animals, a specific part of the brain, it's actually the right amygdala, lights up in a flare of electrical activity. Fox, whale, snake just here, penguin, frying pan, mouse. Your brain lights up for all of them except a frying pan, obviously. And this fact totally stops me in my tracks. We are electrified right in the core of our brains by the animals. They, the great transformers, could transform us if we would let them. So, as well as being psychologically healing, animals are healing for the individual physically. They can work as our first responders. In Ethiopia in 2005, a 12-year-old girl was walking home on her own from school one day, and she was pounced on by a gang of seven men. They kidnapped her, kept her with them outdoors in the bush, and they beat her for days. And then three lions showed up. They drove the men away, and they stayed with the girl, not harming her, until her family and the police showed up, at which point, the police said, the lions relinquished her to them and melted back into the forests. A parrot has saved the life of a toddler when, for just a few minutes, no one was in earshot. No human could hear or see that the toddler was choking. But a pet parrot did. And the parrot became frantic, flapping his wings and squawking, "Mama, baby! Mama, baby!" so loudly that the babysitter, who was in a different room, I think she was on the loo actually, rushed in and rescued the child. The child, by the way, was choking on Pop-Tarts. So obviously the moral of the story is get a parrot and don't give your child Pop-Tarts. There was a pot-bellied pig who saved the life of her owner. The woman was alone in a vacation trailer in America. She started having a heart attack. The pig, who'd been kept as a pet and was very fond of the humans that she was with, the pig forced her way out of the home and went to fetch help. It's an extraordinary story. She went to a crossroads, which was the most likely place for traffic to be, and she went back three times to try and stop a car, eventually stopping a car and bringing the driver over to the vacation trailer, and the driver was able to call for human medical help. And the medic said another few minutes and the woman would have been dead. Without the pig, she'd have died. Dogs have been successfully trained to detect certain cancers, including bladder cancer, breast cancer, prostate, kidney, and lung cancer, as well as E. coli infections and UTI infections and malaria. Malaria, by the way, they can detect by smelling a sock. Medical alert assistance dogs can give people warnings of an impending medical crisis, including diabetes and postural tachycardia syndrome. That's where your heart rate shoots up just as your blood pressure plummets, and it often leads to physical collapse. There's space, if you're standing, by the way, there's space just here, just any if you wanted to know. When I was writing this book, I met a woman called Elizabeth, who suffers from epileptiform episodes. It's like epilepsy, but not exactly the same. And she could collapse without warning anywhere and any time. So if she was crossing a road, for example, if she was cooking over a hot stove, it was really dangerous. And it had led her to end up being virtually housebound. The doctors had told her there was nothing they could do. But when she got a puppy, Lucy, the little dog, quite naturally, with no training, began giving her early warnings when a seizure was about to happen. So Elizabeth had time to sit down and make herself safe. When the medical people can't do any more, then the animals take over, Elizabeth said to me. And it reminded me instantly of a line I know well. The humans have tried everything. Now it's up to us dogs and a twilight bark, says the Great Dane on Hampstead Heath in the film of 101 Dalmatians. He's just heard the message barked by the Dalmatian father. It's Pongo, Regent's Park. It's an all-dog alert. 15 Dalmatian puppies stolen. The Great Dane booms out the message, and it's relayed dog to dog across all the dogs of London. The dogs are taking responsibility. This scene has roared through the imaginations of so many childhoods, leaving us wonderstruck and longing for there to be truth in it. And there is. One day, Elizabeth told me, she was out with Lucy in a large park, and the dog gave her a warning of an imminent seizure. Elizabeth sat down, but it was a bad one. Lucy dog knew she needed to call for backup. She also knew by sound and scent that another particular dog was in the park who belonged to friends of Elizabeth's. So Lucy barked for that one dog. And that one dog understood the message and barked back in a way that its owners understood to be urgent. They could see they must follow. They did, and were able to get to Elizabeth and get her the human help she needed. Animals heal us being very good yoga instructors. Dogs on standing up obviously do the downward facing dog stretch, but the cat, cow, crane and crocodile all have their signature poses in yoga. And there's a bee pose too, which a yoga teacher told me how you do it is you crouch down, you cover your eyes with your fingers, then you lean forward and you hum like a bee. And this, she told me, stimulates the brain, which is exactly what happens in the human brain when we hear bees. The sound of bees stimulates the cerebrospinal fluid in the brain, and that is really good for the immune system. I've always been really scared of death. But learning about animals transformed that. Animals can accompany us in death. They can give us a hospice for the heart. When I was writing this book, I talked to the artist Amy Shelton, and she told me that in her mother's last few days of life, her mother kept saying the bees were coming to visit her. She said she had ordered her death from a bee, and she could see that the bees were guides trying to show her the way, not where, but how, to be able to undertake the journey of death. And a palliative care consultant I spoke to told me that in one hospice where she worked, a cat moved in who seemed to feel an astonishing and very particular duty of care, which was that the cat would know when somebody was really close to dying. It was a consolation to the patients, and it was invaluable to the staff because they said they could ensure that the patient's family and friends had a little bit of advance warning. When I spoke to the consultant, she said the staff were sometimes right about the exact timing of somebody's end, but the cat was always right. When we think about the healingness of nature, quite often we think of birdsong, that quintessential healing sound. We feel it. Myths note it. And researchers have now demonstrated that hearing birdsong improves people's mental well-being for up to 8 hours. The sound of a cat's purring, by the way, is also really healing for humans. It improves bone strength, and the hurts of in which they purr is also really good for chronic pain relief. But so when I was thinking about this book and I was thinking about health, and obviously you think about, you know, psychological health, you think about the individual, you think about the body and how animals are really healing for the individual. But health is never only an individual issue. Because to be truly well, our societies need to be healthy, with justice, with healthy politics, and with ethics. Indigenous cultures are adamant that animals taught ethics to humans because we are, they say, the younger brothers of the animals. We were savage little creatures, scruffy and rude. We didn't have any manners or any friends. We came very late to the stage, and we stepped into a world that was already ethical. According to wolf ethics, the pack usually lets the hungriest wolf eat first. The pack will usually share babysitting duties for the young pups. Wolves, in fact, operate a kind of welfare state, taking care of the sick and the injured, sharing food with those too old or too young to hunt. We likely got our ethics from wolves. Early humans watched wolves and learned from them, say Australian anthropologists, and Indigenous Australians put it pithily, saying, dogs make us human. Wolves were practicing the ethics of friendship, cooperation, and care hundreds of thousands of years before we humans did. The grey wolf ethos is the closest to a human ethos in all of nature, and they were doing it first. So if in our prehistory, wolves gave our ancestors ethical guidelines, some dogs are laying down the law today. In my book, I've given examples of where police officers had had their police dogs with them when the officers had begun to behave wrongly, violently, towards an innocent person. The dogs, trained to go for the aggressor, turned on their handler, biting them, in one case simply removing the weapon to stop the wrongful assault. But healthy societies need not only ethics, healthy societies need a sense of justice. And in this too, animals can be very good role models. Dogs shake paws for the sheer fun of it, many times in a row with no treat necessary, just because it's a bit of a laugh, until it isn't. Because studies show that if a second dog is given food rewards for shaking paws and the first one isn't, the first dog gets really upset, shows signs of stress, and stops playing. When capuchin monkeys were treated unfairly in an experiment by human researchers, the monkeys became furious. There was a lot of hurling of cucumber slices, and it was because there's a thing with capuchins. They quite like cucumber slices, but they really like grapes. So if one of the monkeys is given grapes and the other one only cucumber slices, it's not fair, and they let us know. Animals can offer political medicine. They can work collectively. They can operate referendums. Honeybees use the most amazing consensus politics when they're searching out a new site, with a process that involves scout bees flying off to seek out possible new hives. Coming back and reporting truthfully and telling the truth is a major thing for bees, on the quality of the sites they find. And they choose a new flight when all the scout bees are in agreement, dancing together for one site. Field fares are really beautiful birds. They have an enemy, though, who makes their lives a misery, the far larger hooded crow. The hooded crow will sneak eggs from field fare nests, and it's horrible to have a hoodie on your tail. But the field fares deal with it in a demonstration of political power. The field fares know they cannot fight alone, so they adopt the first principle of political action: find allies. And the field fares fly together above the hooded crow, and they do a massive synchronized shit. They bomb the bird And the crow's feathers get really oily, so it has to slink off and clean up, otherwise it can't fly properly. Red deer use a kind of referendum. They know their safety is in numbers, so after a period of feeding or resting, they form a consensus decision as to when they'll set off again. They move only when 62% of the adults in the herd are up on their feet, voting with their hooves. I have to say, I love all birds, even hooded crows, really. But I have a particular fondness for sparrows. You may well have noticed this yourselves, but if you haven't, I can tell you there's a study that shows that when house sparrows find food, they do not rush in and gobble it all up. Magpies will do that. What house sparrows do is they first chirrup an invitation to their friends, then they wait for company before they eat. The sparrow is sacred to Aphrodite, goddess of love and beauty, but to me the sparrow is the pin-up bird for mutual aid and friendship. We need sparrow medicine. There are some who could learn a lot from the unionizing spirit of the sparrow. Jeff Bezos, famous union buster, flies into space in a penis-shaped rocket, the prick in the dick, yanking himself off and away from the shared and sharing life on Earth. Then there's Elon Musk, that human sick note, the twat in the tweet, promoting the presidential fart, the twat in the cap, to world domination, that one-man ethical fade sponsoring an assault on political truth-telling. That would make the bees weep. I'm so sorry. Where was I? True health includes the well-being of the collective psyche, which needs animal energy in its art. We understand the meaning of animals. The panache of the peacock suggests boastful bravura and represents the gilded wealthy. The collective noun, by the way, is an ostentation of peacocks, gives you a clue. When the Belgian artist Francis Alice was invited to the opening of the Venice Biennale in 2001, he didn't go. But he sent a peacock in his place, and the peacock preened and belled and flirted his tail feathers, because Alice knew we can all speak peacock and understand the bird's preposterously pretentious meaning. The same artist, by the way, also set a fox loose in the National Gallery one night, and the fox filmed on the CCTV utterly invigorated the gallery. The full imaginative reach of being human needs the animals. We're made of the snort of a horse, a hedgehog bristle, and badger's teeth. We are wren sung and swallow built and seahorse etched, and our imaginations are flecked with turquoise, thanks to the damselfly. Animals not only inspire art, animals can create art themselves. Bowerbirds famously make bowers with found objects, usually blue, chosen and artfully combined as part of the process of attracting a mate. Coco, a gorilla, was born in the San Francisco Zoo, and in the 1970s, she learned 1,000 American sign language signs with her hands, and she understood with her ears about 2,000 spoken words. She, by the way, was very funny. Once she had wrenched a steel sink off a wall and the humans around her looked quite grumpy. So she indicated her pet kitten and signed, "Cat did it." Her Coco also made art. And one of her most famous paintings was a stream in a valley with pink flowers. And she titled it, in sign language, "Pink, pink, stink, nice drink," because pink, pink was her sign for pink, stink was her sign for flower, and nice drink was her sign for good, fresh water. Pink, pink, stink, nice drink. So what of cave art? It seems appropriate to me that the Lascaux caves, with their ancient paintings of animals, should have been discovered by one. It was a dog called Robot. On the 12th of September 1940, Robot began curiously investigating a hole by an uprooted tree, and Robot's human companion followed the cue, and the astonishing works were found. In cave paintings, it is animals that are so often painted. It's really well known, this. In fact, it's so well known that the importance can be overlooked. Well, the paintings of animals are wonderswept and awestruck. The humans, quite often, are just haphazard little stick people. The earliest art, in other words, was inspired by a thrilled, observant, almost certainly shamanistic entrancement with animals. Are the animals a necessary route to the spirit world? Surely yes, and yet I think more. Animals are foster parents to thought itself. They are how humans began to communicate ideas, conjuring the animals in art, or by gesture, or in mimicry. We could translate thought from one mind to another. We could express leap by pointing out the leaper hare, prowl by looking at the fox, vision by pointing to the eagle, and size by the auroch. But set on its brutal extinctions, and thinking less and less through the animals, modernity is writing itself out of the script, paragraph by paragraph, parakeet by parakeet, worm by worm, and word by word. When I was thinking about the collective healing of the human psyche, I thought a lot about fairy tales, which really are our culture's medicine stories. And I think the idea that they are just for children is ludicrous. These stories are not trivial. They are some of the deepest healing stories of our culture, and animals are at their heart. So let me tell you a story, at least the beginning of it. Once upon a time, there was a miller who had three sons. He was a bit of an oaf, and when he died, he left the mill to the oldest son and the donkey to the middle son, and the youngest son got nothing except the sodding cat. One day, it was a dreary day inside and out, the youngest lad was sitting on an upturned bucket outside the stable with his head in his hands, thinking just how utterly miserable his life was and always would be. But just then, the undauntable cat leapt onto his lap, nudged him with her paw and said, "Pah, there's no water in these rivers to run the manky mill, and the mule is a moping mass of mange and misery, but me, I'm a cat of cats, a cat of cleverness, a cat of tricks, and I can bring you mice and tell you jokes, and what is more, I will make your fortune, for I am a cat who can talk. So bring me a sack, a hat with a feather in it, and a pair of boots." So begins, as you know, Puss in Boots, where the wronged youngest child has been made sick with despair. Puss is the ogre beguiler and the princess finder general, providing the youngest son with all the symbolic riches of a good life. And I can attest to the healing power of that story. I've returned to it over and over again in my life. Puss empowers me when I feel weak. Animals heal us in some very measurable ways. Petting them reduces blood pressure. It lowers the stress hormone cortisol. It raises endorphin levels and oxytocin, the cuddle hormone. Very, very importantly and seriously, animals, dogs and cats in particular, are known to have prevented people from committing suicide. Animals can also heal the spirit, that unmeasurable and beautiful part of being human. Chimpanzees perform waterfall dances as rituals. He, it usually is a male alone, approaches a waterfall and begins swaying from foot to foot, stamping, shaking branches to rattling and throwing rocks that crash like percussion, drumming and dancing with the waterfall, magnifying its force, his god body on full alleluia. And at the end of the dances, the chimp moves into a mood of reflection. Jane Goodall has watched these, written about them, and she comments, given how alike they are to us, why wouldn't they have feelings of some kind of spirituality, which she says is really being amazed at things outside yourself. I think, she says, chimpanzees are as spiritual as we are. For many cultures, the animals are creator gods in their own right. The hare is the first creator for Native American Algonquin people. The hare makes the sun and the moon and the earth. God is a cow, the milk of intimacy and mighty benevolence flowing together from heaven. Cow, of course, is sacred in Hinduism. God is a fox, a blaze of intelligence, a perfect nose for night, and a gift for friendship. The Japanese deity of foxes presides over tea and sake, fertility, rice, and household well-being. God is crocodilian. The Egyptian god Sobek took the form of a crocodile, and Sobek's main temple was, I kid you not, the city of Crocodilopolis. God is a raven. He has a beak and wings. He hops. God is a scamp with beady eyes and black feathers. God is not solemn and never goes to church because he's easily bored. A light-fingered thief, raven fingers light itself. He then gives it away in the refracted poetry of sun, moon, and stars. He's a major god for Native Americans of the Northwest. God is a bear for many people, the good brown Bruin of the soil. God is all paws with a taste for berries. He enjoys a tipple. He has a sweet tooth. Bear has been worshipped widely across the world, from the Celts of Gaul and Britain to Ainu people and across North America. Why wouldn't all these be gods? We are already and again walking within the transcendent. There are gods in the woods, a wren on the flute, badger on the sax, and bat on piccolo. Animals ensoul the world, giving the collective psyche limitless dimensions of sacredness. We could, with relief, acknowledge divinity again in the real and living world, knowing it as the truth that has so far vouchsafed humanity's time on earth. And then the collective psyche could come to its senses and the individual spirit come home to itself, letting the soul medicine that has always surrounded us work its ordinary miracles in the holy and reckless plurality of the animals, each one an iteration of life's deepest prayer. Let there be life. Thank you. And I just wanted to say, if anybody has any questions, I'm really happy to answer questions, or maybe to ask some of my own. But also, if you've got things that you want to share about the animals and your experience with the animals, please do. I don't want anybody to feel that they need to kind of shoehorn something into a question where actually they've got something to share. And also because you've just been listening to me for quite a long time. And so if there are things where you've been sitting there going, oh, yeah, because I want to say blah, 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 please do. And please feel free to answer each other as well. It's like, I just want this to be as much of a kind of open dialogue as you would like it to be.
Hello. Firstly, thank you. It was beautiful and poetic and gorgeous. Do you think that everybody can have the same connection with animals, or do you think certain people are more sensitive to it? Like, for example, I go for a walk in the woods and a dog greets me and I physically feel emotion that dog had greeted me, yet my brother, like, couldn't care less. Do you think... Yeah, do you think it's just certain people, or can everybody access this?
Can I say I absolutely love that question? Thank you. So what I would say is that I think everybody can. It's that for most of our human history, we've been incredibly sensitive and alert to the animals, tiny insects and large animals, as well as our pets, you know. And I think that that the way in which all of us as individuals can become more open and sensitive to the animal realm is quite simple. It's by listening. And that the more you listen and the more you attend to different animals, the more you can kind of like step a little bit into their world and know them as individuals and as people, you know, because in my view, there are human people, there are also cat people and caterpillar people. So I would say, I would say we all can, we all used to, and the way is fairly simple. It's listening.
I just wanted to continue that comment in a way, because I realised, because of climate change, I was just appalled to find I was going to have to go plant-based, and I was miserable about that because I loved eating meat. But the joy that that has hence given me, because I never really minded about animals very much before, but suddenly I realised I was not doing the harm that I had done. And there was something about being more at peace with animals, and suddenly I became alive to them, I suppose. And it's been my blessing. I love it. So.
Do you know, I think that is so brilliant. That is so brilliant. You're the first person I've ever heard who talks about kind of, you know, moving to a plant-based diet with, by saying it has been a blessing for me, instead of like, you know, giving up and not doing, or you know, and even kind of like worthily kind of, you know, blah, blah, blah. That is such a good way of talking about it. That's brilliant. Thank you so much. I like to be a shelter in the storm, but thank you.
Thank you, Jay. That was really, really lovely to hear. It's the same kind of thread as well. So I work a lot with dementia, and interestingly, in care homes these days, mechanical cats are really popular. And I wonder what you think about that. You know, is it the spirit of the animal? Because my mother-in-law, that was her main treat at the end of her life, and I was always thinking, it's a bit weird, isn't it? So I'd just be interested to know what you think about that.
I have to say, I'm not sufficiently an expert in dementia to be able to be able to comment. I would say that it's really interesting that it happens, and actually it's great. You know, to me it's like if it works for people who are really struggling, that is brilliant. You know, my guess, but it's only a guess, is that there probably is a lot of kind of, you know, deep memory of sort of something that, you know, of a cat, and then that recalls it. But also, I mean, if they're good toys, they're good toys, you know. I like a good toy. I've got a koala glove puppet. It's fantastic. It's called Brian.
Someone over here.
Thank you so much for your very poetic talk. I just wondered whether as part of your research you'd ever come across stories or instances where people had had experience of what we might call the supernatural with regard to animals. For example, animals having premonitions or coming back as ghosts.
It's a really good question, and the answer is fairly simple, which is no, I didn't look at that at all. And one of my reasons was because everything in the book I wanted to be able to say, and all the kind of notes and references are at the back, so it's not interrupting text, but at every point I wanted to be able to say, this happened, and here's the proof, and here's the, you know, and here's the study. So in a way, almost by definition, that isn't something that I could go into. But if it's something that you feel happens, I'm not saying it doesn't, I'm just saying no, I didn't.
Oh, obviously we're known as a population in the UK of loving pets, okay? But we're so wildlife depleted on the international scale. I just wondered what you could say as advice to help people broaden their outlook from, instead of thinking their dog has the right in the woods, which is what I hear a lot, to actually understanding that we are going with our pets into a wildlife zone. So I wonder if you could give us anything that would encourage us to think wider than just our pets in the UK.
Wow. Wow. Is that all? Okay, that's brilliant. And actually, thank you for kind of introducing it as a topic. I mean, one of the things that I do feel is really good about pets is that they're kind of, you know, that they can work as ambassadors for all other animals. Although, that said, is that for a lot of people, it's still their own animal or, you know, their own individual pet. But I think also that that talking to people is one of the most important things, of just kind of saying, oh, do you know, that's where this creature lives, and that's where this, you know, that's where this animal has its home. And then kind of, you know, if you felt brave and you felt like saying it, kind of, you know, they're really scared of dogs, by the way, you know, something like that. There is an amazing project being run, I think it's called the ASRA, A-S-R-A project, which is about looking at a particular environment from the point of view of the birds, the otters, the fish, the kind of the, you know, the wildlife there, and asking humans to educate themselves into how those animals kind of feel and perceive and what those animals need and what they don't need. And in fact, one of the things that keeps coming up in that project is that humans feel immensely strongly how frightening dogs can be for many animals. And it isn't a sort of thing of kind of, you know, prioritizing or blaming or anything like that. It's a matter of empathy, and it's a matter, again, like I was saying earlier, of listening, and that thing of kind of, you know, which in a way I would so like to feel, is that we humans are becoming better and better at listening to other humans. And that maybe this is an extension, it's just beginning to listen to other animals as well. And it's a slow, slow process. Thanks for bringing it up.
Yeah, thank you for your talk. I was thinking of your story about the bee and talking about the bee. And it brought back a memory I heard of that bees were, when people died, the apiarists, the relatives had to go and talk to the bees in case they died of stress because the beekeeper had gone. And this must go back right to the beginnings of time when people first looked after bees. I just wondered if you'd heard of that story.
Yes, thank you. I've included it in my book, actually, and that thing of, like, go tell it to the bees is the importance of saying, kind of, you know, that the beekeepers died. But interestingly, I never heard anybody say it's because if you don't, the bees will feel stressed about it. So thank you. I didn't know that. But it's such an enigmatic, beautiful way of considering the relationship between us and bees. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your talk. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about the way that human beings have tended to distinguish themselves from animals in a sort of hierarchical status. You know, we're more complex beings and they're more primitive sort of thing. I was wondering if you covered that in your book at all, and what could be a way to kind of bridge that divide, because human beings are animals really at their root. So... And also, what you said about something about cat humans, that was quite interesting. You mentioned it earlier.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for asking that. So, I mean, when we're thinking about, you know, the sense of human superiority to animals, I would put a little kind of brackets around that, that it's very much the dominant culture. It's kind of, you know, what we used to call the Western world. It's certainly the non-Indigenous culture, which has seen that kind of superiority and acted on it. And it's got a very long history. It's got a long history, you know, through from Aristotle and through certain kind of parts of the Bible and through medieval scholasticism of just saying that there is, you know, there's a hierarchy, there's a scale. And it's not true. And it's very self-serving to kind of look at the world like that. And it's kind of so much more obviously, like, kind of if it's going to be a shape, it's the shape of a tree, not the shape of a ladder, with kind of all sorts of things branching and, you know, branching on out. So I have mentioned it briefly in my book, but, you know, but I feel very aware that this is, you know, this is a kind of part of our intellectual history that is quite unwise, and that indigenous cultures have a lot of wisdom about how our animals need to be treated and related to. And that relates to when you were saying about, you know, the kind of cat person thing, is that so Inuit people, for example, would talk about even a spider is in its own way a person. That's literally a quote. And I just find that so interesting. It's like saying that kind of, you know, it's not saying we're the same, or that a spider is the same as a chimpanzee, or that a chimpanzee is the same as a hedgehog. It's not saying that, but it's saying that there is personhood. In other words, there's a kind of spirit that deserves respect and that is, you know, is an individual. Even woodlice, this is one of my favorite things that I learned when I was researching my book. Even woodlice have a kind of individuality. They have the beginnings of, they have the very beginnings of empathy. It's not empathy, but it's the first building block of empathy, which is emotional contagion. Now, we know that as you hear someone talk about something really sad and you can hear them crying and it makes you choke up. It's emotional contagion. You know, somebody gets the giggles, you don't have to know them, but you'll probably start giggling too. So that's emotional contagion. And we humans kind of typically think, well, we've got it and the animals don't, but even woodlice. And so there's this study that was done where you'll know that if there's a nest of woodlice and you disturb the nest, they'll disperse, right? But if a nest has a really calm woodlouse in it, just one, and I called him Thich Nhat Hanh because I didn't think Thich Nhat Hanh would mind, and so you've got a really calm woodlouse, then the other woodlice in that nest disperse, but much more slowly, because they pick up a calmness from the calm one. And when I read that study, I was like, oh, this is amazing. It's like this world is more and more amazing with every single study I read. Like baby jumping spiders dreaming. It was a study done in the pandemic. It was a biologist who wasn't able to do the field trip she had organized. So she thought she'd got to find something really close to home. And what she found was a nest of baby jumping spiders. So she got a really, really, really big magnifying glass, looked at their eyes, and saw that when they're babies and the pigmentation hasn't yet come in, so you can look through the exoskeleton right into their eyes, is that you can see that as they're asleep, you know they're asleep because it's like, you know, they've gone into rapid eye movement, their legs are twitching and they're spinning, but they're not awake. And she was like, oh my goodness, it's like baby jumping spiders dream. We know that dogs dream, cats dream, you know, we know that zebra finches dream. And when they dream, by the way, they dream of singing. Rats practice going through mazes. If they're being kept in mazes, they practice when they're asleep. I mean, so yeah, one thing after another, I was going, yeah, we are surrounded by people, just people in different forms. And, you know, it was one of those books where at the beginning I really, you know, I loved animals, but I did not know all that much. But everything I read, I was like, oh, look at this, and look at that, look at this. So thank you for your question.
It's a question about plants. We know that division of those two forms of life is false. It's just a different form of life, a different form of communication and maybe intelligence. And we all have the experience of going in a wood, and we all have experiences of being by an old tree. Have you looked at any of your research about the therapeutic effect of plants on humans, and then the other way around, the therapeutic effect of humans on plants? I gathered that some Franciscans talk to their plants and they grow quicker.
Could you say that again, that last bit?
Franciscans talk to their plants and they grow quicker.
Franciscan monks? Oh, I misheard you the first time. I thought you said San Franciscans, like people in San Francisco. And then I thought, no, I think I misheard that. But no, it says San Franciscans. That's so beautiful. Thank you. Short answer, no, because it was like when I was writing this book, it was animals healing. And the more I read and the more I researched, the more I thought, oh, there is so much to say. So unfortunately, no, I couldn't. But you are absolutely right that, you know, that plants undoubtedly are good for us. You know, when rain falls on the living earth, you know, the scent of petrichor is really good for us. It's that, you know, yes, they are. And no, I haven't written about them. But maybe you should.
You talk a lot about sort of like, you know, animals having its effects on, animals having effects on people. I was just wondering whether, like, it could be the other way around, like cats having, feeling comfort around humans. Because I remember during COVID, so I was like 17 when COVID hit, and me and my cat would just sort of like curl up and I'd do my homework and stuff like that. And I think I definitely found a lot of comfort in that. It was just sort of like whether, you know, the cat felt sort of the same way. I don't know, just, yeah, just curious.
I didn't strictly look at it, but I think that anybody who's got a pet will really know, kind of, you know, it's when they seek you out and kind of, you know, when they want to be near you, they sit in your lap and kind of curl up with you. And cats are very choosy, and they're choosy about what they do at every hour. And so if your cat curled up with you, then I think your cat wanted to. And actually, by the way, cats and COVID was, I started writing my book about animals in at the beginning of the pandemic, because my cat was such a consolation to me. And at one point I was, you know, because it was a lot of things that happened that, you know, it was just, it was a very difficult time, as it was for many, many, many people. And at one point I was looking at my little cat, his name is Otter, because he came on the day of the otter, according to the French Revolutionary calendar. Anyway, so I was looking at Otter and I was just, I'm so grateful to that little animal. And then I thought, he's really healing for me. And then I was thinking, yeah, animals do heal, don't they? And I was thinking, yeah, because there's that, and then there's that, and then there's that. And then I got a bit of paper and I was just like, you know, and a pencil, because I was writing pencil, and it was like, well, this is this and this. So yeah, cats and COVID, absolutely. Thank you.
It was more of an answer, actually, to your question. And really interesting, we've got a family of cat lovers. When my stepdad died, his cats actually sat with him until the undertaker came. But also, my daughter, I think cats often go away when they're going to die and find somewhere safe. The cat actually chose to die in her bed. So, yeah, don't know, may answer that, may not.
That's an incredible gesture of trust, because they do, they often do just go off somewhere on their own and find a quiet, dark place. Thank you.
Of the slightly less cosy variety, but maybe something we can all take home, because soon, obviously, the weather's changing and the spiders will all come into our homes. And this isn't really based in a study, but apparently spiders are really receptive. And if they're in an inconvenient place in your house, if you talk to them, like the bee person, and you ask them to move, they will pack up their web and go to a different place in the house. So if you say, spider, you're in a really inconvenient spot, if you wouldn't mind packing up and just moving, and then apparently they will do that. So, I mean, obviously, I'm not going to... This is not a study, but maybe in your own personal experiment, you can go home and talk to your spiders if they're in an inconvenient location. And
oh, I love
tell
that.
Me what you think.
I absolutely love that. Do you want to do some cleaning at my house? Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Jay. We're going to finish there. So can we give a massive round of applause to Jay?
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.